word on Today FM.
Breda Brown, Communications Director at Unique Media, and Lorcan Nine, Head of Training at the Communications Clinic. And there has been one of the most unexpected, and I think unique, political stories of recent times this week, when we had a newly elected TD to Dáil Éireann, Owen Hayes of the Social Democrats. A story in the Irish Daily Mail about how he had shares in Palantir, which is a company, a very controversial company, which does data analytics and data mining on behalf of security services, previously mainly in the US, run by this rather strange billionaire, Peter Thiel, but which has in the last year or so been supplying its services to Israel for use in its war against Hamas and Hezbollah, which has caused up tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent people as well. And Owen Hayes was asked about when he sold his shares in Palantir, and he couldn't quite give a straight answer. Let's hear him.
I have divested completely from the shares.
When?
I completely divested from them within the last 12 months.
When exactly?
Yeah, I made an ethics declaration as a double city
when
councillor.
Exactly did you get rid
I'm planning on making sure that I abide by all ethics
Sorry,
declarations
when
in the
exactly
future.
Did you get rid of the shares? That's the question. Keane said last week that it was this year. Can you give us clarity on that?
Yeah, it was this year.
When?
It was this year.
I was elected in June.
Yes, so yeah, it was. So you got rid of them before you entered politics in June.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it could have been the 1st of June. It could have been the 31st of May. Like,
look, I divested from them entirely before I was elected to
so before the 7th of June.
When was that exactly on?
I was elected on the 7th of June.
Except he didn't sell the shares, Lorcan Lyon, before the 7th of June when he became a local councillor. He sold them when?
He sold them after he became a local councillor.
In July.
And so I think, whatever you think about the specifics of the dates that he was saying, he made a clear distinction there of before he entered politics or before elected and after elected. And I think that's the core to it. That just ultimately was not true. If you take a step back from it and you look at it from a crisis communication point of view, like if he was being advised, if he was looking at this as a crisis, which it was once it hit the front pages, the first thing you do is you get your timeline. What's the timeline of events? What's the timeline of what happened here? The second thing you do is you get the truth out on the table and say, what actually happened? What did you actually do? What were we actually dealing with? And then when it comes to communicating it, when you are ready to communicate it, you communicate everything, you communicate the truth of it, and you don't have to go back out for a second statement or a second crack at getting the truth right initially. All of those rules were clearly broken here. He was not prepared. I think if you look at the individual at this, I always have sympathy for anybody who's caught in the middle of a storm like this, not sympathy for what he did, not sympathy for the fact that he had to be suspended, because I think that was the right call, but sympathy for him as an individual. He's new to politics, new to national attention, he's in the middle of this, but I don't think he was properly supported. I don't think he properly planned out his communication. And then also, look, he didn't tell the truth, and even wider than that, he ran a campaign around a certain number of issues and a certain kind of approach that he then was revealed as a bit hypocritical in the issues here. And Ellen Coyne had an excellent piece about it, I thought, during the week, made a number of points. But she also made a very interesting point about Irish politics, where she said scandals aren't often revealed, but they're noticed, in that kind of the details of them are often there and people maybe just don't pay attention to them, and then suddenly a spotlight gets put on them and it's like, oh, we did kind of notice all along, but we've pieced it all together now, and then it becomes an issue.
But see, Breda Brown, it goes further in some respects, doesn't it? I mean, this is his relationship with the Social Democrats who have suspended him. Will he be readmitted or will he be expelled permanently, allowing him to sit as an independent TD in Dáil Éireann? Because there's a couple of reasons why they must be livid within the Social Democrats. One is that they have made such a major issue out of Israel and about that nobody should have any contact or business dealings with Israel. That's the first thing, and that's been consistent since last year. But secondly is that he gave them the wrong information and they went out to bat for him, and they went out strongly to bat for him. And then Gary Gannon, I think, for which he has subsequently apologised, went on a podcast and started making allegations against the journalists who were correctly and legitimately pursuing the story.
Here's the problem. The trust that was built up is now gone. So how you recover from that is going to be the difficulty. And going back to what Lorcan said there about the timeline, how easy it is to get a timeline right and get all the information out there. He defied the odds in Dublin Bay South because to get that seat, because it was quite a funny sort of constituency. But he was coming across as a fresh face. He was very visible in the locality. And I think that's why now people are just so disappointed that they feel sort of let down. So the constituents who voted for him will feel let down. But also, as you said, the party, the Social Democrats are now going to feel let down. In terms of what happens next, I'm not really sure. I think we need to go and look at the party rules. Has anyone looked at the party rules or the constitution in terms of, you know, what happens if somebody is suspended, how long that suspension takes place for? Is there a route back into the party? What do they have to do to adhere to that route to make sure they get back into the party? Or maybe he just takes a view at this point and decides to stay as an independent.
Should he stay in the Dáil? There's a big argument about, has he misled the electorate in relation to his views and his behaviour, and the fact that he still had these shares at a time when he was a councillor? Because there are arguments been made that essentially he came from behind on the back of transfers to take a seat which it looked like would go to the outgoing TD, Chris Andrews of Sinn Féin, who ironically probably was the strongest pro-Palestine and indeed you could say anti-Israel member of the outgoing Dáil. And there it is, Chris Andrews is out of his job, out of his seat, to be replaced by Owen Hayes.
And Matt Carty came out during the week and said that Owen Hayes wouldn't potentially have got the seat if the electorate had have known this in advance. And obviously that adds to his argument then that Chris Andrews would have got the seat. So, look, this is down to Owen Hayes now. It's a moral dilemma. Potentially, it's, you know, his future is on the line here. His reputation is on the line. It's up to him to make that decision.
I'm not sure if we have a recall mechanism in Irish politics. I don't think we have like they have in the UK. I remember Ian Paisley Jr. once faced the possibility of a recall motion. They were looking for 10,000 signatures to think. In American politics, they have this thing. But I wonder, you know, then again, if Owen Hayes was to resign his seat, would Chris Andrews necessarily win it in a by-election, given the vagaries of the PR system that we have?
Well, yeah, by-election is a very different election to a general election. So, you know, I would doubt it, given the makeup of the constituency that they're in, that there will be a by-election victory there for Sinn Féin. Look, the system we are in is that it's up to the politician to decide if they resign or if they want to weather a storm and go through it. We know when we're voting, that's the system we should be voting. If we vote for the individual, we don't vote for the party, but very often what happens is you vote for the party.
I'm just thinking the thought of a by-election now in the next couple of months, would that be the quickest by-election ever, I wonder?
Possibly. Because a listener here says if they lost their seat for misleading the electorate, we'd have no TDs.
Well, this is a very cynical
listener there, Matt. But look, I think, you know, you mentioned there that the Social Democrats as a party had a very, very firm view on Gaza and on Israel. Owen Hayes himself did as well, where he did call for sanctions. Look, he's been suspended for the misleading element of it. Whatever your view on it, if you look at his view and his view saying there should be sanctions, there are definitely questions to be asked individually of saying it's not just when you sold the shares, it's what did you do with the money that came from the shares as well.
So half of it would have gone intact. 52% would have gone to the state in income tax.
Yeah, but the other half did go to him. And if his opinion is that businesses shouldn't be dealing with it, that there should be sanctions, is there an element of a question of saying, well, you did profit from the sale of his shares after the company started being involved?
If he'd held on to the shares and only sold them last week rather than July, he'd have made $500,000 profit rather than $999,000 profit.
Now, interestingly, he's also giving back. There was a GoFundMe page set up for him as well, which had got in, I think, €8,000. So he started giving some of those donations back now to people to obviously try and reclaim some of the reputation.
I don't think the fact that he would have made more money now, though, is relevant to the moral question based on his own moral positions of whether he should or should not have profited from it.
This listener says it's his money in shares, it's his private life. But it's not actually, because there's a register of interest that you actually have to sign up to when you're actively involved in politics.
And if he had said nothing about the situation in Gaza, well, then there would be no hypocrisy here. But he did, and therefore there probably is a degree of hypocrisy. It's interesting now to see if him as an individual politician, if he decides to say, okay, my route forward now is going to be as an independent, and therefore I've to start working as an independent politician, or will he keep the head down do the suspension, and that hope in 12 months, in 18 months, he can re-enter party politics and that career path. Because we've had a lot of individual politicians who've gone through a lot of scandals down the years that when you look back at them, even in one election cycle, you think, were they the one who were involved in that gate? Were they the ones who were involved in that vote? And you do kind of forget, or the electorate does forget. So there is a path back.
Or as an independent, could he enter and join one of the independent groups potentially and be end up being the third leg of party in power?
Next thing you'd be proposing him for junior ministry, so
you know, listener, or the Crown Corps, one or the other.
Okay, let's move on. Listener says, America's basket case status has just been confirmed. Time person of the year. That same person should be serving time for years. No, the Time magazine person of the year, which is not that significant really, I think, is not necessarily given to the person they regard as the best or the most outstanding. It's just the person who has dominated the news cycle, Lorcan, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you have to say that Donald Trump has dominated the news cycle this year.
There's been a lot of kind of eye-rolly takes on this by people who I think know that and yet still try to make the point. They say themselves, Time, that for it's better or worse their influence on the world. I mean, who has the most influence? Not the best influence, the most influence. Every single time somebody is elected US president, they are the Time person of the year that year, right? Every president bar, I think, Gerald Ford, since they've started doing it, has been the Time person of the year. FDR got it 3 times, Nixon twice, Reagan twice, Obama twice, Bill Clinton twice. This is just what happens, all right? It's an American publication. America see themselves as the absolute center of the world and center of the universe, and therefore the US president is the most influential person in their view in the world the year that they get elected. So it is not a big deal. It is not a big deal at all in the slightest that he got this. And actually, he probably is the most influential person. I mean, we're
even
constantly talking about him.
But Trump
next to Elon Musk, maybe.
Trump being Trump is obviously making it the biggest deal that it can be made in terms of making sure that we all know that he's president-elect. You know, before I read this story today, I'd sort of happily forgotten that Donald Trump was the president-elect.
That's just a hiatus.
I know that. But I read this and I went, oh, good God, right, it's all starting again, or it will all be starting
you're
again.
You're in denial,
in
Breeda.
January. I think I probably am, because in the interview that he did with Time magazine, he was talking that one of his first official acts as president is going to be to pardon some of the rioters who are accused or convicted of storming the Capitol to block the certification of Biden's victory. That's his priority. He said he's going to do that in the first hour, probably in the first 9 minutes. So that just reminded me of, I suppose, the chaos that's ahead of us in relation to all.
But you know, he's never had higher favorability or approval ratings in the United States. Just, you know, despite the fact that he has won the election twice, he has never actually had a higher approval rating than disapproval until now. Mm-hmm. So people seem to be swinging around to him at the moment.
Come back and ask me again in March once we see what's happened in the first 2 months.
Once he comes in, you're going to see a huge amount of action happen that Donald Trump has told us and told the American voters he was going to do. He has been very, very direct this time on what his plan is. I mean, that the idea that he's pardoning them is not new. He has said it before. The fact he's going to start mass deportations is not new. He has said it before. He has kind of said quite consistently what his policy agenda was. There is no confusion. There is no subterfuge, really, this time with Trump. He said what he's going to do.
Does Owen Hayes need to take some advice from Trump then? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying the American people know what's coming. We should all know what is coming. It is probably going to be chaotic. But I think that's probably part of the element with the approval ratings as well, Matt, where it's been a bit clearer this time. I think there's kind of been a general reaction to it this time, which has said, look, maybe this is just who we are. You know, maybe we've revealed that actually we're okay with a guy like this. We're okay with this policy. We're okay with this approach. And he has driven the policy conversation and the policy agenda in America completely. I mean, the Democrats throughout the campaign were talking on his talking points, effectively talking about them differently, but they weren't bringing it to the left. They were trying to show that they would also be tough on immigration, etc. So he won the argument long ago. He's now won the election. And I think the left in America, the Democrats, are kind of like yourself, Breed, at the moment, just kind of, disengaged a bit. They've given up a little bit, and we'll see what happens.
The last 4 years, we've woken up every morning, just looked at the phone to see what might be on it. That's fine. You didn't pick up the phone worrying about what might be on it, whereas when Trump was in power, you didn't know what the news was going to be overnight that might have happened. So I think people are a little bit concerned about what's coming down the track. But as I say, let's talk about it in March.
Paul Mescal has become one of the world's favourite movie actors. And that meant he was given the role of host of the American TV show Saturday Night Live last weekend. And here's part of his opening monologue, which has been criticised for lazy stereotyping.
People also think the Irish hate British people. That's not true. We just don't consider them people.
Okay, Rita Brown, what do you make of that?
So he's been accused of Brit bashing. He was like actually a giddy child. I watched the video back earlier on. He was so delighted to be there, to be on Saturday Night Live. He nearly couldn't believe his luck. And he had a 4-minute monologue at the start. And generally what happens there is people send themselves up, which he did. He was taking, you know, the mic out of himself, and he wanted to talk about stereotypes with the Irish. Now, unfortunately for him, it didn't go down well. And this is not the first time that he has sort of put his foot in his mouth around all of this. So he's been given out to, obviously, around this stereotype. He did it again recently when he was asked about King Charles in London at the premiere of Gladiator 2.
I thought he handled that one quite well.
Well, he basically said, "I'm Irish, so it's not high on my priority list."
Yeah, I thought that was a rather skillful way of actually dealing with it, and he said it's more important to Ridley Scott because it means something to him.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite a diplomatic way of actually dealing with it.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily agree. And then the other one was when he was on Graham Norton then with Saoirse Ronan, and they were talking about if somebody attacked him with a phone, he was like, "I'm not going to start thinking," or attacked him, you know, that he would try and save himself by using a phone. And that's when she came in with her, "Well, that's what girls have to think about all the time." And he was subtly chastised as a result of that. So it sort of feels like a little bit of foot and mouth syndrome over the past couple of months.
What do you think?
I wouldn't agree. I think Paul Mescal carries himself quite well. I thought his genuine enthusiasm that you cited there was actually quite refreshing, that he's able to kind of remain this awareness of, this is a bit mad that I am hosting Saturday Night Live, and it comes across quite genuine and quite charming. The joke wasn't funny. He had another joke about people think that Irish people have sex with their cousins. We don't. We have sex with our second cousin.
That was a bit odd.
Which was a bit more offensive, actually, but it also just wasn't funny. The issue was that the joke itself wasn't funny, but I think he carries himself relatively well. There is always this big reaction, and it's particularly in the last number of years, that we're so hyper, I think, sensitive to this idea that we might be Brit bashing, that then we almost look for examples of it. That the joke wasn't funny, but it wasn't offensive. It wasn't even overly negative, really, either. It was a throwaway remark. There we go. We move on. I thought he achieved something almost unique, actually, in a secondary sketch on Saturday Night Live, where he was on a sketch on Saturday Night Live that was actually funny. After it as well, he had a sketch where it was what Irish Americans expect when they walk into an Irish pub, and it was somebody says that they're a quarter Irish, and he rings a bell and says, "Oh, somebody has come back to home soil," and they celebrate and they're delighted and say, "Please tell us about your heritage," and it was sending up the Irish American thing.
But isn't that all cliched Irish though, as a result? Do you know what I mean?
The point of it was to be cliched Irish, so it was, here's what they imagined, but it wasn't the result of it. Normally they do the cliche.
But does he have the comedic ability to carry it off? And I don't think he does. And this is the point that I'm making, that like, stick to the knitting. You're good at acting, so stick with that.
Okay, listener comments, you know, on this. Come on, Paul Mescal bashing. He's done nothing. And I think fair play to Paul. The British should be able to take a joke after what they did to us. He's your classic Irishman and is doing the Irish proud. Another one says, surely he didn't come up with these jokes. It's the writers who American come up with them and they think they're hilarious. Now, in fairness, Saturday Night Live hasn't been hilarious in God knows how long, has
it? But he's saying it. So surely if he doesn't agree with it, then he could say that he doesn't necessarily agree with it. You know?
Yeah, Paul Mescal took the Saoirse Ronan comment very well, and she told it very well. It was a joke on SNL. It doesn't have to be funny, but it's still a joke.
I would say on a wider level, I don't think there's anything at all wrong with what Paul Mescal said or how he said it. And again, I say I think he came across quite well. We have fallen in, in particular in the last number of years, into this really, really boring form of nationalism, which is defining ourselves once again by our dislike of the English, or that we're different to the English. I don't find it offensive. I just find it mind-numbingly boring. I actually just don't care about what the UK are at anymore. I think any nationalism that is still going on about 700 years, 800 years, you can be proud of your history without banging on about it all the time.
Okay, let's move on. And I think listeners will know that one of my favourite TV shows of recent years has been Succession, which many people believe was modelled on the Murdoch family, Rupert Murdoch's children. And now there's been a bizarre sort of twist in that there's a major legal battle going on in the family. And according to court documents obtained by the New York Times, the children of Rupert Murdoch began devising a public relations strategy for their father's eventual death after watching the fictional portrayal of chaos erupting within Logan Roy's media dynasty. Let's hear a clip from episode 3 of season 4 of Succession. Spoiler alert, yeah, Logan Roy died. I think at this stage you know this. And this is where Kieran Culkin as Roman Roy in the episode Connor's Wedding had this to say.
I hope you're okay. You're okay. You're going to be okay. Because you're a monster, and you're gonna win. Cause you just win. And you're a good man. You're a good dad. You're a very, very good dad.
Okay, that was the bit where he was realizing that his dad was dead. But what I'm really taken by this one, Breda, is that it took them to watch a TV program to realize that for a 90-something plus man, that they better have a strategy ready to deal with when he dies.
I love the fact that no matter how rich you are, there's always infighting going on in a family. It doesn't matter. Yeah, you'd sort of have to wonder. And considering that Succession was based on their family anyway. Murdoch was basically trying to change the structure of the family trust to ensure that his eldest son, the golden child, got everything and was able to control the future of the company. The other three kids... The other three weren't happy about this. So this is why they had a legal challenge to it and the whole thing went to court. And as part of all of that, all of this documentation came out saying that the children began devising a PR strategy for when their father eventually died after watching this fictional portrayal. Now, the first rule of PR and comms strategies is that you plan for every potential scenario. And obviously, given the age of Rupert Murdoch, you would have thought this plan would have been
Succession,
a place years
they
ago.
Never believed that Logan Roy would die anyway.
I've never seen Succession.
What?
It's now been spoiled for me. What I used to always say when people ask about this, I don't watch any prestige or good television. I watch what I would kind of safe, uncontroversial telly. I used to say like MasterChef. I can't say that anymore. So it's, you know, other television programs are available. But what's interesting about this as a story for me is that it's not about the financials. It is very much about the control. It's about the control of Fox. What has happened is three of them are more moderate in their political views and one is more conservative. And it's about that. It doesn't affect the financial empire at all, this court case. It's all about the control of the narrative that Fox obviously is conservative media. The more conservative son is currently in charge and the more moderate kids are the ones who are trying to bring it maybe slightly more towards the centre. And that's where when the break happens with the initial Trump presidency. So it's about the control. And I mean, Fox is the most influential media outlet in the US. I mean, the most phenomenal thing in the
I've been given out to for ruining Succession for people. It's more than 18 months old, that particular episode. And everyone knows it was built up to what was actually going to happen. It was only a question of the timing. My apologies, though, if you were only coming to Succession now. Lorcan 9, Breda Brown, thank you.
The Last Word on Today FM.